Good evening, and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Our guest this evening is Josephine Halverson, American artist, curator, professor, and guest lecturer. She is renowned for her on-site paintings that come face-to-face with an object in its environment. Josephine is currently professor of art and chair of graduate studies in painting at Boston University College of Fine Arts. She has also taught at the Skowhegan School of Painting and Sculpture, Yale University School of Art, and been invited to lecture and participate in panels at a wide array of universities nationally and internationally. Josephine received a Bachelor of Fine Arts from the Cooper Union in New York, and an MFA from Columbia University, also in New York, and has attended Yale Summer School of Art and Music in Connecticut. Josephine has been the recipient of numerous grants, awards, and residencies, such as Fulbright Fellowship to Vienna, a Louis Comfort Tiffany Foundation grant, a year-long fellowship at the French Academy in Rome, and she was the first artist to do a residency at the Giorgio O'Keeffe Museum in 2019. Josephine has been involved in numerous solo and group exhibitions throughout the United States, Europe, Cuba, and Asia, and her works are held in many prestigious collections. Good evening, and welcome to Art World Innovators. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Susan. Happy to be here.
Thank you. You have long been a close observer of that which most people habitually overlook. In your current exhibition, On the Ground, your vibrant paintings explore your encounters and interpret the narratives you envision in overlooked landscapes. Can you walk us through your observations and process for bringing these landscapes to life and connecting the viewer to what is in front of them?
I've been thinking about that word overlooked for a while, and in this exhibition, which are all paintings of the ground, the meaning of overlooked is more literal than in the past, in the sense that it is the ground, and I'm stepping over it as most people do without necessarily inspecting it or visually scrutinizing it the way that I do as a painter. But the overlookedness of something also has a certain kind of moral undertone, as if we're too busy kind of doing something else, that we don't notice what's right in front of us, and that somehow has the key or answers something bigger. I'm not sure where I stand, as it were, in terms of the morality issue, although still life painting, which is the genre that I'm most closely in dialogue with in my work, often has allegories of moral tales and particularly of vanitas and mortality. So as I look at the ground and as I've made these paintings, I've been thinking about their time and my own time in relation to them. Around the paintings that I've made is what I call a surround. It's a kind of frame that is on the same plane as the painting with the same materials, but it also includes bits of rock and debris that I collect at the site where the painting is made. And I sand it down to expose that aggregate of that material a little bit, a little fleck of evidence of a place. And one thing I've been thinking about in terms of time with these is how rock possess such almost incomprehensible scales of time within them from their own making. And being a painter who's so sensitive to living in my own time and the duration of my painting, the in-real-timeness of my own observations and brushstrokes, it's a very strange interplay between the 600-million-year-old pebble or a bit of rock and the minerals that make my paintings and colors and, of course, my own time painting it. So inherently, they are a reflection of time and life cycles, and so choosing to look at them seems to be a lot more than meets the eye. And that's something I've always been drawn to in my own work, trying to see more than what I might first glimpse.
Are there any mentors or renowned artists who have inspired you to explore various directions and mediums?
So many. I think about art history all the time, and it's hard to know where to begin. I feel very privileged to be an artist and a painter, and I take that responsibility and gift pretty seriously. So I think about the people who've come before me. This particular body of work was inspired by artwork that I saw when I was in Italy, when I was a fellow at the French Academy in 2014-15. And I was able to look at a number of artworks of that year very closely and in person, which really informed the way I thought about how I wanted to make a painting. So for instance, there was the unswept floor at the Vatican Museum, and that's a mosaic of the floor. It's a Roman copy of I think a Greek mosaic, which depicts little bits of food and detritus which have fallen from the tabletop in theory and then illusionistically represented to scale through mosaic form. So for instance, a lettuce leaf is painstakingly arranged in these different greens to show its contour and at the same size as the lettuce leaf. It's really beautiful. So in terms of the ground, that was very important. And then also the frescoes that I saw, the painted garden of the Villa Olivia, which is at Palazzo Massimo, that was absolutely extraordinary in terms of light and color and movement. And then all of those in the Archaeological Museum in Naples, which were excavated from Pompeii and Herculaneum. And I also got to spend some time with earlier frescoes that are either Etruscan or Lucanian Greek, such as the ones in Paestum, where the calligraphic stroke of a line, when painted, became very integral into the rock, which was a material that was used for tombs, for these tomb paintings. Those are some very ancient points of reference, but ones which were really present in my own mind when looking at the ground, which, as I mentioned, has a far longer history than my own life or even examples of Western art history that I'm giving. But more recently, in the zooming all the way forward to the present time, there are artists whose work I think about a lot, in particular with this body of work. And I think two who are probably the most relevant is Sylvia Plymouth Mangold, a painter who I learned about just after graduate school and someone whose work I've studied very closely. And she's painted observationally as well, but also included a ruler as a point of reference or a masking tape, which is to scale, which kind of reminds you of your own act of looking. And in that sense, calibrate your own way of understanding the context of your viewing of the painting with what it represents. And secondly, Jasper Johns, who's been really foundational to my work as well for many years, who I think works in similar ways of trying to understand the relationship between an image and materiality and the mysteries of viewing.
Your work also takes the form of a sculpture where you do bring measurement and ruler in. Can you describe your sculpture shown at the New York Sculpture Park, Storm King?
Yes, that was a project I did in 2015, 2016, and I made three large-scale sculptures, which were also paintings in that they were one of a kind and painted and then exhibited outside in three different locations within Storm King's campus, and which is a large, sprawling sculpture park in the Hudson Valley. And I am so grateful to the curator, Nora Lawrence, for thinking of my work with this, because I'm a painter and it gives me a chance to realize some of my ideas in another medium. And so as someone who is interested in perception and seeing the world in front of me and encountering it, both in terms of natural and cultural, I guess, landscapes, one could say, it was an opportunity to create almost the implements of viewing that I inherently would use in my own painting practice. So for instance, a ruler to gauge the scale relationship between myself as a human body and the world around me. In the case of Storm King, other artworks, many of which are monumental in size, and of course, surrounding landscape. So I don't know if you have done this, but there is this very basic cognitive riddle, which is that something very far away can actually appear in the palm of your hand or vice versa. It's a very strange sensation of understanding our own scale relationship with the world. So standing next to one of my pieces at Storm King, a whole mountain ridge could kind of fit within the span of its size. So it was a way to heighten a viewer or a visitor's relationship to the environment around them. And they were painted in ways that corresponded to their particular sites at Storm King. One, for instance, which was a trompe l'oeil tree, which was nestled in a grove of trees opposite Barnett Newman's broken obelisk. It was the same height as that, as an example of how to calibrate a size and scale relationship between the viewer and the environment.
When you're doing some of your paintings, you often commit to a site full days uninterrupted, and sometimes it works well and others it can be a bit challenging. What was involved before you began the clock that was documented in Art 21?
Well, for about, I'd say, maybe 8 or 10 years, I was painting in this way, not unlike photography, where I had a very reliable methodology of setting up an easel and making a painting, the oil paint, over the course of a day on canvas, pretty traditional approach. And what changed was my encounter with things or the conditions of the painting, people I met, different geographies, different cultural context, different weather, so much that was unpredictable, that painting provided the pretext to be able to witness or participate in. So in, not unlike, say, a camera gives you a chance to look at the world maybe more closely. So I would say that this way of working had a lot in common with what's called psychogeography, of picking up on the feelings and sensations of a place as you wander through it. And I never quite knew what I was going to paint until it spoke to me or seemed to, as I've said in the past, kind of make eye contact with me, call out to me, and then I would set up my easel and make a painting. The clock painting, which is, as you say, featured in the Art 21 documentary, was a great motif because it was representation of time, which, as I mentioned before, has always been very central to my work and interest. It was a mural. It was painted by hand. Often the subjects that I chose during those years, even though I didn't intend for any thematic coherence necessarily, I tried to really pay attention to those hunches and spontaneity of painting. But nonetheless, I found that I was often drawn to surfaces that bore history, that revealed time on them, images of time itself, for instance, the clock, frames, facades, etc., faces. So these were, one could say, the face of a clock on a mural, which was what I painted, was in a way kind of the ultimate subject for me to paint. That said, that painting I made in the documentary, it was not successful, and I've never shown it and never will. It was, as is often the case, some work and some don't. After that period of time, approximately that decade of working them that way, I was in Italy. I made these large-scale sculptures in making editions of prints and have innovated my practice to where it is now in its current exhibition. I'm looking ahead. I'd like to have another chapter of a certain kind of reliable way of working where the changing conditions of my encounter with things in the world can be the variable, but the methodology can remain consistent again.
Do you have any particular project coming up with that technique and direction?
Well, I have this exhibition at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum in the fall. I've made several paintings for that, which were made in Georgia O'Keeffe's Ghost Ranch house in Abiquiu, New Mexico. However, that's a specific project that relates to her and to that geography. But all I do know is that after the semester ends, from May onwards, I have a leave for the fall. My plan is to have no plans and see what comes out of my paintings.
As far as a teaching career, what do you find most rewarding?
As someone who pays attention to all the little things, trained myself to do that, I think that that has helped me as a teacher to pay attention to students' interests and the nature of their work. The role of attention is totally parallel between teaching and painting for me. I've learned so much through teaching. One of the greatest pleasures about it is to see how my students define painting, in particular in art, in new ways all the time. It's an MFA program in painting, and so everyone is working more or less within the medium and materiality of painting, but it is, in its most expanded sense, it's more like a think tank of what's possible within this ancient medium and how to engage in a contemporary way with it. It's also, by nature, by definition, in a way, painting, particularly in an art school context, tends to take place in a very particular locale and time period over the course of a semester in the studios. The students really have to see it in person, and they work alongside each other in their own studios, but they're adjacent in both a communal space and a private space. My studio is also located in there as well. And I think the energy of having that many people exploring the possibilities and trying to walk the edges of what to them defines their interest and their motivations is exhilarating, because there's no one way to make a painting. There's every single person has a completely different take on what it could be and brings their own life experiences to it. So it's a feeling of great vitality and possibility that I'm exposed to and contribute to, and that's what made me want to continue teaching.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much for speaking with us today and sharing your innovative story and valuable insight with us. It's been a pleasure, and we wish you continued success.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure speaking with you as well.
Thank you. For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to Art World Innovators on UMFM 101.5. Joining us this evening is Alan Lakovetsky, a highly renowned Winnipeg contemporary ceramicist whose innovative high-fire techniques and process are internationally inspired. His early study at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design, the University of North Dakota, and his mentorship with master potters in Canada, the UK, Australia, and Asia have contributed to his many years of producing exquisite work shown in exhibitions around the globe. Alan's studio is located outside Winnipeg, surrounded by brilliant natural landscapes of the prairies near Okamic Marsh that he embraces in his pottery. Alan has taught ceramics in numerous universities, done workshops, and exhibited in Canada, US, France, Japan, China, Korea, and Australia. His ceramics are in many public and private collections worldwide. He has also been inducted into the International Ceramic Artists Association based in China. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Can Can you tell us what first inspired you to become a potter?
Well, that goes back a long, long way, actually. My father was in the furnace business, so I was around furnaces a lot. And I remember as a kid watching our furnace downstairs and looking through this little mica window and seeing the fire starting up. And that was quite exciting for me. But not only that, beside the furnace, he had an old handmade crock that he made wine in because it kept the wine warm. But I remember the nice smell that it gave off. And then also caressing my hand over the handle, and my fingers fell into the thumb marks that the potter had left when they attached the handle, and realized, ooh, this thing is handmade. Somebody was actually there and left that message of that thumbprint. And I think that might have been one of the sparks that lit my fire that eventually came me later in life.
So who are some of your most important mentors during your artistic development and over the course of your career?
I started out in British Columbia on one of the Gulf Islands, and I was interested in Zen philosophy, and that kind of led me to the Japanese tea ceremony and looking at these tea bowls that they used for the ceremony and finding out there was much more to them than just a bowl that you drink tea out of. And that kind of led me to looking at pottery in general and who was out there and where I can find information. I picked a book from the library, and it was called A Potter's Book by Bernard Leet. And it was the perfect book to pick because he expounded on the philosophy behind pottery, and particularly Korean, Chinese, and Japanese pottery. And that really was one of the things that ignited my fire as well. And I went on to study with one of his apprentices, John Reeve, at Nova Scotia College of Art and Design. And that really got me started.
Some of the other ones along the way? You were in Australia and you did some other work there and teaching. Who else was influential at that time?
Well, I did come back to Winnipeg after living in BC and came across an exhibition by Robert Archambault at the Thomas Galleries and thought, this work is the kind of work that I'm very interested in, the kind of work that I want to make. So I did come back and studied with Robert for 2 years at the University of Manitoba. That was before I actually went to Nova Scotia College of Art and Design. So that was pretty major as well, and it continues to be major because I'm constantly in contact with Robert. So he's been one of my more important mentors. But aside from that, after Nova Scotia College of Art and Design, I went to Australia, and I worked with Peter Rushforth, who is one of the original potters, grandfathers of pottery in Australia, and also Gwyn Hanson-Piggott, who was also very prominent both there and in Europe. She was an apprentice with Bernard Leach, Lucy Rhee, and Hans Koper. So they all had a different kind of influence on me, and I think it was really important to have that kind of mentorship with artists who were kind of operating at a high level internationally. So I feel very fortunate to have had contact with these people.
So can you describe a particular piece or series for us that will give us an idea of the clay materials you prefer to use and the process for creating your pottery?
Early on, way back when I was a kid, I was always very interested in fossils, and they kind of blew me over, the idea that these critters have left this message that really is hundreds of millions of years old. And, you know, the rocks, the age of the rocks and the geological processes that these things have gone through really have cemented my interest in material. Natural material. So looking at clay is hundreds of millions of years old. And I just think all these particles, where did they come from? Where were they originally? And what journey have they been on over all this time to get to my hands? And if they could tell a story, they would be some pretty amazing stories. So I respond to clay because I feel that it's a very sacred material. It's a living material. It's so impressionable. You just lightly touch it and you leave your fingerprint in it. And you can see in ancient pottery, the potter did exactly that. You know, as they picked the pot up, they left their fingerprint in it. And it's kind of a message that they've left. And I somehow find that quite fascinating.
You also, in your practice, use a traditional treadle wheel when you're making your pottery, and it's part of your process. What is it about that that you prefer?
Well, I use a combination of foot-powered wheels. One is a treadle wheel, and it's a wheel that used to be used by one of the grandfathers of pottery in the USA, Warren McKenzie. So I have it here in my studio, and I consider it quite an honor to have it and to work on the wheel that he spent many years working on. And I have another kick wheel. It's a different type of wheel where you have a heavy flywheel and you have to get it moving, and then it has its own momentum. You don't have to constantly kick it like the treadle wheel. But it's significant for several reasons, because I like to use my own energy to create my work. Also, compared to an electric wheel, they don't have the motor noise that I don't like. It's not a creative sound for me. I like to listen to the wind in the trees and the birds outside, so I can't do that if I have a motor constantly making that noise. But this other kick wheel is significant for me because it was one of the wheels I learned on when I first went to the University of Manitoba. And they, a few years ago, decided to sell them because I guess they take up too much space. And I was able to buy one. So I have one of the original wheels that I learned on in my studio. And it feels really nice to have it there.
That's great. And is it important that your works are functional as well as aesthetically pleasing?
Yes, as a matter of fact, the functionality, the concept behind it is that it serves an everyday purpose. For everyday people, it's not only for other potters or other artists. I get the response from people all the time that, you know, I just love your work, particularly mugs. I use your mug, your coffee mug, every morning when I get up, and I just love it. And I realized one time that, you know, I have hundreds and hundreds of those out there, and it's fantastic that people, hundreds of people, thousands of people perhaps, are sitting there every morning at an important time of their day, just waking up with my mug, and it's quite an intimate thing because they put that mug to their lips. I just love the fact that I'm able to provide that opportunity for them. It's a form of communication I find really important for me. It gives my work a real sense of purpose that I respond to.
Your works are in a number of collections around the globe where their functionality is experienced and benefited by a number of people. How did your travels contribute to the main ideas and techniques you learned, and how did they contribute to your artistic development?
I'd like to have cultural shock, if you like, influence me in a way. A funny thing to say, but when I go to different cultures, and most of them, of course, are much older than Western Canadian American culture, usually the places I go to have many, many years, centuries of ceramic history, and it's very interesting to be in that environment, to see the areas where traditional historical pots have been made for hundreds and hundreds of years, and also witness the techniques that the potters and artists are using still today. It has an influence in some way. I don't think about it too much. I allow the whatever influence it does have to go through a natural filtering process. How it comes out, I don't really pay much attention to, actually, but I know it's there. And the more traveling I do and the more work I do in other areas of the world seems to give me a sense of depth and more confidence in my work. So there's a point where the work just starts to make itself. And I think that's from all the different influences I've had from many parts of the world.
So with the cultural exchange of ideas and the many influences from around the world, what do you feel are the advantages of living in Winnipeg and having your studio in a rural environment in the Canadian art scene?
I've always been interested in the rural environment. Even as a kid, I lived in West Gildon, in the most northern part of Winnipeg, when there was nothing past my street, basically. It was all country, and now it's Garden City and the maples and all that. But I used to take my bicycle out to the prairies and just somehow responded to nature and being outside the city. But being from Winnipeg, I think it's a wonderful city, a quiet, sort of out-of-the-way place. It happens to be the center of North America. I don't know if spiritually that has any effect on people, but I think it's a relatively quiet place. The politics here are not dramatic in any way. I think it's very safe. It's a good community to live in. And particularly, I'm very proud to be Canadian. The more I travel around, the more I realize that Canada is one of the very best countries in the world. And all the people, international people that I'm in touch with, think the same. They have an opinion that compared to most places that they've been or where they're from, Canada seems to be one of the more stable countries. So I tend to agree with them and feel very fortunate that I'm from here.
You've also researched many aspects of designing and creating ceramic works and shared your knowledge and findings with students as a professor and teacher in art schools. What do you focus on, and what is your main advice for students interested in pursuing a career as a potter?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, as you gain more experience, I think you have much more to teach the students. And I think it's more than just teaching a curriculum. I think one of the things that I have to contribute most to students is the mentorship. You want to be able to impart information to students that will take them past the school. There's a life outside of school, and I feel it's important to give students at least a glimpse of what it's like to be out there and how to survive. That's the big thing. If you're standing in front of a class teaching and you feel that the majority of them won't survive, it doesn't feel very good. So trying to create an atmosphere where students are not only learning about what you're trying to teach them in terms of a curriculum, it's important to provide them with that kind of information and to think about what's next. It's exciting for me to be in that environment where young people are enthusiastic. They want to learn, and they're excited about what they're learning. I feel that it's a privilege and an honor to be there, and I know that they sacrifice a lot to be there, and they pay a lot. So it's not easy, especially nowadays, to be a student. And important for me to feel that I'm giving them as much as I possibly can.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being on our show. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you for having me. Always interesting for me to talk about my work and my career. It sort of gives me sort of an opportunity to take another sort of look at myself from another direction. So I appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
That was contemporary ceramicist Alan Lekovetsky speaking with us from his studio near Oak Hammock Marsh in Manitoba. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.